Hello and welcome to another episode of I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by broadcaster, journalist, writer, publishing director, and a man who not only edited the legendary Smash Hits, but launched magazines such as Q, Empire, Mojo, Heat, and The Word. He's just released his latest book, Nothing Is Real, The Beatles Were Underrated, and Other Sweeping Statements About Pop, David Hepworth.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you for being here. Well, you live here.
Yes, I do live here. I didn't have to go anywhere at all. You came here.
Thank you for living here. The 1963 album with the Beatles.
Yes, I have to be honest, if I'd had a clear run at it, I would probably have chosen A Hard Day's Night, but that's already been taken.
It has. But
I'm perfectly happy to dine a ditch over with the Beatles for reasons that I hope will become clear.
During your discovery of the Beatles, where did this come in your collection?
Well, I think it was the first long player of the Beatles I had, because I was very fortunate. I'm very fortunate to be, I'm kind of first generation as far as this is all concerned. You know, I was born in 1950. So, when the Beatles came along, I was 12, 13. Mm. And long playing records were not things that you could easily afford in those days. You know, they were things that can only be indulged in thanks to kind of birthday money or Christmas and so forth. And so we had some Beatles singles, certainly like Please Please Me and From Me to You, and Twist and Shout was a huge thing.
There was a lot of EPs being released.
EPs were a huge thing because you could afford them, yeah. And and the EP is a much maligned carrier, really. But the first long player that I remember getting of the Beatles was with the Beatles. And this would be Christmas 1963. And we had a friend of the family who was known as Uncle Stan.
Okay.
And Uncle Stan came from the other side of the Pennines. I grew up in Yorkshire. Trailing clouds of Rothman smoke and sophistication. He was a kind of Frank Sinatra, Peggy Lee generation, ring a ding dinger, and he used to focus on me because I was the kind of 13-year-old who fancied himself being interested in music. Mm. So he used to patronise me from a great height, and he used to come every Christmas. Now I've never forgotten this. I've written about this in my book actually. He came in Christmas 1963 and said, "What are you listening to now, then?" And I showed him my copy of With the Beatles, newly acquired. And he listened to me enthused. And then he said, "Now, mark my words, I'm going to come back next Christmas and you'll have completely forgotten about it." Well, the poor soul, he arrived the following Christmas to be met by my copy of probably Beatles for Sale.
Yeah.
And then the following year, and it was Rubber Soul, and I don't know. And by 1966, the guy must have been thinking, why did I pick, of all the gin joints in all the world, I had to pick this group to make my point about the ephemeral nature of popular music. Why couldn't I have chosen Jerry and the Pacemakers or Billy Joe Kramer and the Dakotas, who would have been forgotten by then?
Did he turn up in 1970 and say, "See, I told you they'd never last"?
I don't know. I think by then I'd left home. So, those kind of battles were behind me. But I do remember that, very much, he chose the Beatles and I felt sorry for him. Because they were the exception to all the rules. And just like he was a big Frank Sinatra fan, and Frank Sinatra was the exception to all his rules.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? He was just different. You know, he invented he invented the music he did, just like the Beatles invented the music of their time.
Yeah. The cover alone is just a massive statement.
I suppose so. Yeah, it was slightly at odds with their kind of mop top cheerful image, you know, to do something, you know, with the half in shade and half in light, you know. But, you know, one of the things I've tried to write about in, you know, in my book, which started with this piece about the Beatles were underrated, and it's become clear to me that that the Beatles were kind of rediscovered in many ways. Well, A, after the death of John Lennon.
Yeah.
Because during the 70s, hardly anybody talked about the Beatles, it seemed to me. And in the post-John Lennon, that was different. And then you got the anthologies and all that sort of stuff, which kind of arrived around the same time as Britpop.
Yeah.
And they found themselves being kind of, you know, nominated as kind of godfathers of Britpop.
Yeah.
Which is a view of the Beatles very much skewed towards their later stuff, their beardy, weirdy stuff.
Yeah.
And I think, well, that's all well and good, and that's fine. But actually, the genius of the Beatles was the early kind of mop top years, really. You know, which I remember, you know, completely at first hand. And, you know, so the cover is... He's very much at odds with the sound of the thing, which is just utterly joyful all the way through. And what I remember about it, you know, I got it, we must have got it on Christmas morning, and it was probably shared between me and my sister. And it is no exaggeration to say we played it all day.
Wow.
We just played it all day because you didn't have many other records. Mm. And if you did, then probably your parents' soundtrack of South Pacific and a kind of Shadows album, which probably wasn't all that good.
Yeah.
And suddenly there was this thing that was just kind of excitement and joy incarnate, which it still communicates to me now, you know.
Yes, yeah.
It's happy.
Mm, it is joyful.
So the cover is a little bit kind of goes against that, but I suppose it's also just, it's kind of remarkably confident, isn't it?
It is, and it's very much like the Astrid Kircher photos she took in Hamburg.
Yeah, it's that kind of moody bit of the Beatles. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It won't be long,
album itself starts with "It Won't Be Long," which is, well, what is it?
What is it? Well, it's a great album opener, I suppose, you know, and it's attack, isn't it?
Mm.
Attack, 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 you know. And one of the things that struck me about the Beatles, listening to them as I do still today, is how up-tempo they were. You know, is a kind of... Their default position was up-tempo.
Yeah.
The default position of most bands is not up-tempo. Mm. It's kind of slow. It's let's do it at the pace that we're comfortable with.
Yeah.
That goes down to the level of our lack of competence. Whereas the Beatles had been raised in kind of however many shows a night, however many shows a year. It was, you've got to hit them. You've got it absolutely straight away, you know. And so many of their songs just start like that, you know. And you can hear it later on, and, you know, even things like Help. And you can go and think, if you go and listen to things like Tomorrow Never Knows, the amazing thing about Tomorrow Never Knows is how up-tempo it is.
Yes, despite being any a dark other group, psychedelic masterpiece.
Any other group in the world would have slowed that down. Yeah. Let's make this really meaningful. Absolutely. They don't do that at all. It's absolutely clips along. And, you know, I think one of those most admirable qualities was that they had quite short attention spans.
Yes.
And therefore they suspected that the audience probably had quite short attention spans as well. And so, you know, it won't be long. Yeah, yeah. And it's all that call and response stuff, which is so important to what they did.
Yeah.
And, you know, and
it's almost defining them as a band, isn't it? Saying, look, here's me singing this one, there's the guys. And it's sort of telling their story through this.
I think we have great difficulty with the early Beatles getting a kind of proper respect for them. Because I think a lot of the things that they did, people don't do anymore. They've completely forgotten how to do it. And there are kind of cases of this all throughout, you know, throughout this record, you know. But they were, you know, it Won't Be Long is a terrific, you know, example of their attack.
One of the four John compositions. I love the opening line. It's pure John. Every night, when everybody has fun, here am I, seeing all on my own. There he is.
I suppose so. Yeah, I suppose so. But still sung in a very, very up way, you know, just as he did with Help and things like that later. You know, it was just, that was their thing. They were trying to, you can't imagine, you know, when I was 13, 14, just how happy the Beatles made you.
Mm.
There was nothing else that made you that happy. You know, and so my kind of affection for them still is partly rooted in my recollection of how happy they made you. Yeah.
Whenever I want you around, yeah, all I gotta do is call you on the phone and you come running home. Yeah, that's all I gotta do.
All I've Got to Do, which is very sort of Arthur Alexander-esque.
Yes, yeah. Well,
track.
You know, they were going back to my point about the, you know, they exemplified loads of things that we don't understand anymore. They were a covers band.
Yes.
The Beatles were the world's greatest wedding band. They were.
Yeah.
There are examples of that throughout this record. If you got them to play your wedding, they would be brilliant.
They would be.
They would do something for the elderly ladies.
Yeah.
They would do a funny number. They would do a knobbly knees competition. They would do a rave up. They would.
Yeah.
Because that was the school that they'd come up in.
Mm.
You entertained the audience that was in front of you rather than necessarily made your artistic statements. That came later. And so, you know, the reason compositions like All I've Got to Do are not bad, and, you know, because they'd only just started really writing songs because they dropped it for ages. But I do think one of the things that made them good songwriters was they'd spend years studying, you know, Motown records or Arthur Alexander records or God knows what, and they'd take them apart and they knew how they worked. That's a fundamentally different discipline from what bands have done for the last 30, 40 years, which is what most bands do nowadays is they write within their capabilities. Whereas the Beatles learnt stuff that was beyond their capabilities. And then their songwriting went up to join it, you know.
Yeah.
They learnt how to take things apart and put them back together again.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you.
Effectively, as you say, this is pretty well a covers album. There's four John compositions, two of Paul, and one of George. They let him have one as well.
Yeah.
Plus,
yeah.
I Want to Be Your Man, which is we'll come to shortly. But this is the kind of the moment where the older generation may have considered their songwriting skills. Track three, All My Loving.
When I was working on this book, I toyed with the idea of making the title Close Your Eyes and I'll Kiss You.
Really?
Because I think it'd be a great name for a book. And it's you know, it's more than a song, isn't it? I have to think, talking about the Beatles as songwriters can be a bit misleading, really.
Yeah.
Because there weren't songwriters like Cole Porter was a songwriter or Rodgers and Hammerstein were songwriters. They wrote records. And and all my loving from the beginning. You know, the hairs on the back of your neck, from the way it starts, you know, and that kind of welcoming embrace of it. I think it was 2003, I was doing some work for Paul McCartney. We did a tour program, magazine, thing, right. whatever. And he was very generous and said, come along, you know, they were opening at Earl's Court, bring the family, whatever.
Wow.
Now, I'm not the kind of person who ever says to my children, who are all grown up now, you should go and see so-and-so, it'll do you good. Or I really don't believe in that. Hates that stuff. Mm. But I said, who would like to go and see Paul McCartney? And they were, whatever age they were, you know, 20, 15, 10 or whatever at the time. And they all said, yes, really? I want to go and see Paul McCartney. Genuinely. So we went, my wife, three, you know, teenagers. And he came on, and I think he started with Hello, Goodbye. And I think he did Jet. And then the third number was All My Loving. Mm. And I just thought, this is brilliant. This is like being with your kids, seeing the Beatles. Yes. It's an extraordinary thing. Because I go, great respect for McCartney, because I think he understands that. And I think he, you know, he is the world's biggest Beatles fan. So that's why he gets to run the Beatles.
Yeah.
Still.
We saw him at Hyde Park. Was that probably around the same time when he played at Hyde Park? Same thing. I think that was pretty well the set list he started with. And he came in with All My Loving, and we were looking around, and people were in tears. And it was, it's not, you know, you think, well, Hey Jude, or well, the more poignant songs, they're the ones that are going to break your heart. Everyone was crying, and it was that, you know, we've known this song all of our lives.
Yeah, it reconnects. I mean, I hear it now, and it reconnects with me with my 13-year-old self. You know?
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, again, another thing that we don't sufficiently respect about them is they made records for teenagers.
Yes.
Yeah. Their fans were kids. They weren't sophisticates.
No, until you know. Later.
Yeah. Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but I'm to blame. It's plain to see. So go away, leave me alone, don't bother me.
Track 4, Don't Bother Me, George's first song.
Well, it's not bad, is it, at all? It's not bad. And it's one of those things that, in fact, is more than not bad, actually. It's pretty good. And I think it's one of those things, if you listen to it now, you realise what George Martin was doing, even quite early on. You know, it was filling out the sound.
Yes.
There was more going on in that record than would have been going on in a Hollies record.
Yeah.
Or a Cliff Richard and the Shadows record.
Yeah.
It was kind of density and depth in there, you know.
Yeah.
That, you know, they were just incredibly fortunate to meet him.
George Martin's role, it differs slightly in this album, as opposed to Please Please Me, where he was just getting it down on tape. But he's quite happy to experiment and explore with them on some of the tracks. So, I mean, the percussion on Don't Bother Me, for example, there's some crazy stuff going on there. But already he's given the little snippets of what a recording studio can do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And both. They were just very fortunate to meet each other. You know, the Beatles story is studded with little magical coincidences like that. Yeah. And the fact that they ended up with him rather than Norrie Paramore. It's just absolutely extraordinary.
In a parallel universe, there's that band.
Well, I was talking to Kenneth Womack, who written a two-part biography of George Martin recently, and just, you know, said what would have happened if they'd not met George Martin. And he said two hits, and they would have been back in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And I think he's probably right.
Yeah.
You know, he managed to mine something that others wouldn't have heard at all.
Because I still can't believe he heard the Decca tapes and he took the plunge. That's a very brave thing to do.
He didn't want to, did he? I mean, the complicated story is that he was strong-armed into doing it by EMI's publishing wing, who thought there was an opportunity to have some copyrights that might be worth something.
Mm.
Therefore, you'll take these guys on and you'll give them a go.
Yeah.
But the thing that amazes me is that, and I think it was really key, is that when they'd finished Please Please Me, he said, "Congratulations, you've done your first number one." Which is an extraordinary thing to say. You would have thought, what a hostage to fortune that is.
Yeah.
That yeah. won't work, you know. And so he said it, and he was right. And consequently, they believed him. You would, wouldn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
It's your first time in a recording studio, pretty nearly. And this guy says, "You've done everything right here."
Yeah.
You think, oh my God.
And then it happened.
And then it happened.
And there, suddenly this authority figure became, he knows what he's doing. And
absolutely.
Their respect for him was just, bearing in mind how rebellious they were.
But also they were sharp enough to know that they didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that was, you know, they were bright guys. They may not have been educated, but they were bright guys. Little child.
Well, little child.
Everybody had a harmonica in those days.
They did.
Everybody had a harmonica.
This one starts with one and a half, yeah. isn't it?
Nobody could afford a guitar. Drum kit, give over. Nobody would tolerate it even if you could afford it. But I remember in those days, everybody had a little Herner chromatic harmonica. And everybody else had a pair of maracas, which somebody's mother had brought back from Spain or something.
Oh, right.
So it was almost skiffle, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody can make a decent noise on a harmonica, you know. And so that's what happens with little child, you know. And of course, isn't it funny, that whole tradition of songwriting where girls are referred to as children?
Yeah. Today.
Well, absolutely. But that's the R&B tradition.
Yeah.
You know,
it was like a child, like baby.
Go back and listen to Bo Diddley or Muddy Waters or whatever.
I was going to say Bo Dudley there.
No, there you go. You know, you'll come across that stuff all the time, but it sounds a bit quaint now, you know. But it's a very exciting track.
It's a three chord wonder, isn't it? They've written all of Please Please Me, all the tracks they used on Please Please Me. Is this already their difficult third album?
But they've already done She Loves You. And they're about to do I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yes.
Which is just incredible. I can remember hearing I Want to Hold Your Hand on Thank You Lucky Stars.
Oh, yes.
Where it was played for the jukebox jury knockoff that they had. You know?
Right.
And I thought, my God, that's exciting. And I thought, nobody's made that noise before.
Oh yeah, I tell you something. I think you'll understand when I say that something. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold.
If you were actually around at the time, I had no idea. From my perspective, I grew up in the 70s and obviously the Red and the Blue albums.
Yeah.
So you could hear the progression across the two double albums. But for you, actually experiencing this development throughout their career, was it generally as each new album came out, you were expecting the unexpected?
It was more the singles than the albums, really.
Right.
Because most people couldn't afford the albums.
Yeah.
And you didn't, you know, the album culture didn't kind of exist at that time. You know, if you go back and look at the reviews of Beatles for Sale, it's very much track by track, based on some journalist has gone along to the PRs and heard it once.
Yeah.
And then gone, track three, John plays whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was no sense of, oh, this is what it stands for. This is what it, you know, this is how it kind of adds up. It was all part of an unfolding story. You know, pretty much everything you'd heard, you'd never heard before.
Mm.
And we were incredibly receptive. You didn't think, Oh, that's a bit of an odd thing to do. I can remember hearing things like "She's a Woman" on the B-side of "I Feel Fine", and thinking, "Oh, that's a bit. That sounds slightly unfinished."
Yes,
but nobody kind of got superior about it. They just thought it's the Beatles. Yeah. It's brilliant.
Yeah,
we love the Beatles. Everything that the Beatles do is terrific, and you know, there's a new one coming in a few weeks' time or whatever. It was just, you know, immensely exciting. "I Want to Hold Your Hand" was kind of, it was a huge, huge moment, it seems to me.
Mm.
And that was the one that broke them in America, wasn't it?
Oh, big time, yeah.
First, which one you cannot separate from the assassination of JFK.
Yes, which is same day this album was released, strangely. Is
it November 1963? Yeah. Mm. Was it actually the same day?
Yeah. Yeah.
God. Didn't know that.
Very prophetic.
I can remember sitting at home hearing the news about Kennedy on the TV news, that they first of all had word that he'd been involved in some accident.
Right.
Something involving a motorcade. They didn't know any more than that. And then sort of 2 hours later, whatever it was, the news that he was dead. Which was utterly huge. Utterly huge story.
Mm.
But I didn't realise it was the same day as with the Beatles. My goodness. Because in those days, release dates, you know, people weren't queuing up outside HMV or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It simply didn't work that way. You went and bought a record at your kind of local record dealer, which would generally be someplace that had previously been selling electrical goods.
Right. There was love all around, but I never heard it singing. No, I never heard it at all till there was you.
Cover of "Till There Was You", the Mother's Favourite.
Well, absolutely. You know, they were a, you know, like an Irish show band. You know, that's what we do.
Yeah.
We have to have something for everybody. And, you know, it's a good song.
Very Paul.
Well, I suppose so, yeah. But, you know, if you go back to "Please Please Me", doesn't John writes that it's initially inspired by a Bing Crosby song, isn't it?
Roy Orbison, wasn't it?
Roy Orbison and Bing Crosby.
Oh, okay.
Because he'd heard a Bing Crosby song which had a line like, "Please open your ears to my pleas" or something like that. And he thought, oh, that's clever.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they listened to everything because there wasn't that much to listen to. Now, don't forget, during this time, you know, this is the golden age of British 45 making pop. There's no Radio 1. There's the Light Programme. How many records does the Radio Light Programme play in a day? A dozen, possibly, across the whole day. Because there were needle time agreements enforced with the Musicians' Union. So you would hear these songs done by the Joe Loss Orchestra, with Elvis Costello's dad, Ross McManus,
yes,
as one of the singers, which is why Elvis grew up with all those Beatles demos in his house, because his dad used to get them from the publisher before they came out. So you've got to learn this, it's whatever it is, "I Feel Fine", because we're going to do this with the Joe Loss Orchestra. And so that's how you heard those things. So when you actually heard the real thing, the record, it was unbelievably exciting because you didn't hear it most of the time.
Or you'd hear the BBC sessions.
Which is the worst possible. You know, and that was the cultural chasm
right there,
which was, and to my parents' generation, they couldn't really hear the difference between a song done by this bunch of musicians and a song done in this recording by this particular group of musicians. They couldn't hear what was different. And so our entire enthusiasm was based on, we wanted the record.
Yeah.
And the Beatles, you know, art was based on the record, not the song.
Track on side one, we're going to go vinyl. Please, Mr. Postman.
Please, Mr. Postman. I mean, you know, one of the great Motown cover, Marvelette song.
Yeah.
You know.
It's got a very Tamla Motown feel, hasn't it, the whole
I would venture,
album.
Actually, that all their cover versions of soul songs, soul and R&B songs on this record are better than the originals.
Wow.
You know, Please, Mr. Postman by the Marvelettes is a really great record. This is slightly better.
Yeah.
Because it's just got a bit more edge to it. A bit more attack to it.
The beginning is just...
Yeah. And, you know, they're learning how to record Ringo's drums and so forth. It sounds better to me, you know, which is something I would even say about the next track, which
yes.
is... If you flipped over the record...
Flip away.
George Harrison doing Roll Over Beethoven by Chuck Berry. Oh, she got a dime. The music will never stop. Now, the first live show I ever went to see with Chuck Berry, the Bradford Gaumont in 1964, I saw the Nashville Teens, the Animals, Carl Perkins and Chuck Berry.
Wow.
And it's been downhill ever since. and let me tell you, you know, Chuck Berry was brilliant. But his version of Roll Over Beethoven is not as good as the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not. Because Chess, they were very hit and miss in the way they recorded things. Yeah. I mean, sometimes they were wonderful, sometimes they were less wonderful.
Yeah.
And Roll Over Beethoven has just got that attack, you know.
Yes, yeah.
And of course, this is around this time that Chuck Berry is just coming out of prison.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
He'd been in prison in Missouri, I think, for an offence under the Mann Act about taking an underage girl over a state line, allegedly for immoral purposes, although he claimed, well, it's a complicated story, as you can might imagine.
He was a complicated man, wasn't
he? Was a very complicated man in the midst of, you know, a very complicated racial fit-up, probably, but... Anyway, he comes out of prison thinking it's all over, thinking he's never going to be able to regain his you know, previous prestige. And he finds that his songs are now more famous than they were when he went in, thanks to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Animals and all those groups
who
just did Chuck Berry songs. Because you had to be able to do Chuck Berry songs.
Mm.
You know... There was a repertoire expected of live groups in those days, you know, that everybody had to be able to do. You had to be able to do a bit of Smokin' Robinson. You had to be able to do Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley. It was what you expected of a band who turned up and entertained.
Yeah.
And the Beatles did Roll Over Beethoven terrifically well.
Yeah, they were especially the BBC sessions. I think Chuck Berry is by far they pretty well cover. I think it's half a dozen songs.
Oh, really?
More. Yeah,
they're
usually John. So it's surprising George got to allocate.
Yeah,
the camaraderie on this. You know, they've given George three songs. They're all sort of apart from
I
his
suppose
one.
So.
The two covers.
Well, they needed to get it done, didn't they?
Yeah,
they did this record in a bit of a hurry.
Yeah,
I mean they're all done in a bit of a hurry.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had to get this out for Christmas. It feels so right to hold me tight. Tell me I'm the only one, and then I might
composition Hold Me Tight, which years later he'd actually forgotten he'd written.
Really?
Because he did another song on Red Rose Speedway with the same title.
Eric.
He said, oh, because I thought when I bought it, I thought, oh, he's done a cover of that. But completely. And he had no recollection until all the anthology came out and he'd been becoming a fan again. Just
totally forgot.
Completely forgotten it. It's not one of the greatest songs, but it's still got that energy.
It's not bad. It's not bad at all. It keeps the vibe going, you know. You know, I think of it as being a bit like things like There's a Place.
Oh, that's a song and a half. I love that song.
Which kind of gets forgotten, you know.
Yeah.
But I like it. Like I like Hold Me Tight.
Hold me,
the next one.
You really got a hold on me. Wow.
I'm sorry, Smokey. This is better.
Yeah.
It's better than yours. And you know, normally you can't say that about Smokey Robinson.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, it goes back to this point that they were... And this exemplifies the fact that they were a really good instrumental group and a really good vocal group. Mm.
Well, this is veering into sort of This Boy, Yes It Is. I mean, you've got the two-part harmonies, but then it veers into the three-part harmonies. Yeah. Doing the Hold Me.
Yeah.
And the three voices together. Oh.
And their energy, you know, they've filled all those gaps. That's the thing that strikes me, going and listening to the record now. Go and listen to the kind of the la-las just on this record. There's more work in the la-las on this record than there is in most records.
Yeah, yeah.
They harmonise like a street corner quartet while, you know, playing like a rock and roll band at the same time. And it's those two things together,
yeah,
that kind of makes it sound better, you know. Whereas Smokey's doing it, it's him and a vocal group plus Motown session players, and they're terrific. This is the same thing, just done by a group.
Yeah,
and it's just got a new appeal.
And
to
as
it.
A fan, you can identify. Oh, there's George. There's John.
Yeah.
One thing I've just noticed, I'm just looking through because the notes I've put a lot of the songs they did in the three part harmonies. So. Say This Boy and Yes It Is and Phil Spector's Teddy Bears, To Know Her, To Know Him Is To Love Him.
Mm-hmm.
As well as this, and they're all the same bum 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 rhythm.
Yeah.
As soon as they get that template, they bash into the three part harmonies. So. Mm.
Have you seen one of my favourite clips on the internet is George watching the old clip of This Boy.
Yeah.
In Granada with Tony Wilson.
Yeah. That's lovely.
And he's seeing it clearly for the first time since they did it.
Yeah.
Which is amazing to think. Whereas nowadays, everything is constantly replayed. Those were rare experiences in those days, even for George Harrison.
Yeah, and you can see his eyes light up, can't you?
He's quite touched.
Yeah. Have a look, folks, YouTube.
Oh, it's amazing. He actually goes, good song.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man. Love you like no other, baby. Like no other can. Love you like no other, baby. Like no other can. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your man.
Ringo, for the first time, here's his little track originally tossed off, to use the Ruttles term for the Rolling Stones. I Want to Be Your Man.
Yeah, I can't. I'm not enthralled by I Want to Be Your Man, but you know, I was always amazed that the Rolling Stones did it.
Yeah, what's your thoughts on their version?
It's probably slightly better than the Beatles.
You think? Yeah,
but I don't know why they did it. Well, I suppose Andrew Eldon just thought the Beatles are so hot.
You've got to have a Lennon-McCartney.
You've got to have a Lennon-McCartney song. You know, everybody wanted a Lennon-McCartney song because it was going to was going to get whatever airplay there was going.
I do like John and Paul's, as they said, you know, we weren't going to give them anything great. So they gave that to the Stones, and oh, Ringo needs, I'll give him that crap when we gave the Rolling Stones.
But it's the nerve to believe that we can come up with a better one tomorrow.
Yes, yeah.
Can you imagine feeling like that?
No.
You know, most groups are not like that, you know.
Yeah.
I was reading about Hard Day's Night just recently, you know, that they, halfway, they're still making the film and they had no title. And somebody told Dick Lester the story about Ringo having said Hard Day's Night. And so he said, that's a good title. Yeah. And if that's the title of the film, you're going to have to go and write a song. And they did. Like in days.
I know. And that
and recorded
song,
it.
Not just a song.
Absolutely.
That one.
It was like, they must have been at a stage where they just didn't look down at all. They just thought, whatever we do, it just works. It was their kind of magical period.
She's got the devil.
The third time on an album, not till Revolver, I think he had three tracks on an album before, but a cover of Devil in Her Heart.
Which I like, actually. It's a song that was a hit for the Donnays or something.
Yeah.
And they're kind of middling R&B. You know, it's the kind of stuff that, have you ever seen, they're published, there is a list somewhere on the internet you can find of the contents of George Harrison's jukebox in 1966.
Oh, yeah.
And it's brilliant because it's all kind of middling R&B hits that you've never quite heard of.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was what he listened to.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they all listened to. And this was, the Donnays, I think, was on the Oriole label, which was a label largely used in Britain for, first of all, for Motown Records. Before Motown Records were on Stateside, they came through Oriole. Yeah. So they're obviously keeping an eye on that, you know, as a source of good new stuff, you know. And presumably, was that originally Devil in His Heart?
Yeah, because Paul got a bit miffed when, I think, was it Peggy Lee did And I Love Him?
Oh.
And there's an interview, I didn't write that, And I Love Her.
Well, fair enough. Yeah.
I think if you're going to sing the genre, then you don't change the sex, just be gay for those 3 minutes and go for it.
I always fancied myself as a drummer. And oh, so, yeah. You know, which in those days got no further than borrowing a pair of my mother's knitting needles and some kind of hard surface on which to
break
percuss. And so I would play along with this stuff. And I remember Devil in Her Heart was kind of fun to play along the drums. Similar with the next track, actually.
Yeah, not a second
time.
You're giving me the same old line. I'm wondering why. You hurt me then. You're back again. No. Not a second time.
It's got the nearest thing to a drum break on an early Beatles record.
Yes, it has, yeah.
And that was immensely exciting.
Yeah.
For kind of desktop drummers like me, you know.
That was going crazy.
That was
what
passed for
needles.
A solo in those days. It was like half a bar.
And famously, William Mann of the Times and his Aeolian Cadence.
I was
review.
There.
Yeah,
was he talking about that?
Yeah. John thought it was Birds of Paradise or something he was talking about.
Well, I mean, you
know. I have looked it up. I'm still not quite sure what he's talking about. But.
Well, posh music critics never understand pop music at all. Because they're listening for things that aren't there and they're missing things that are there.
And if they are there, they're probably by like one judgment anyway.
Yeah.
In the context of these very simple Merseybeatish songs, this suddenly goes slightly into new areas.
If I didn't, as a rule, avoid the word dark, referring to pop music, I might use it in the next case.
Yeah.
It's just a slightly melancholy sound to it, you know. I like it. I've always liked it.
The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the best and please not give me more.
To the cover of the Barrett Strong song Money, That's What I Want.
Better than Barrett Strong's record. And Barrett Strong's record's pretty good.
Yes, it is a great song.
But, you know, that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
They wanted money and success.
It's a very honest song, isn't it?
And why the hell shouldn't they? Why do we find that so odd, you know?
Yeah, that's a real statement to throw that on the end of the album, isn't it? And just saying, hey, yeah. Here we are.
Yeah, Cliff Richard wouldn't have done it. Would he? It takes a lot of confidence in who you are, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Going back to the whole record, and that exemplifies it as well. You know, George Martin just managed to make it all sound important.
Yes. Yeah, it's got a certain reverence about it. You can't really pinpoint why.
You can't, you know. You know, he... You know, obviously they played the stuff, but... It was what he heard was what he recorded, and what survived when he mixed it had gone through him.
Yeah, I think his influence on this track especially, because on the Decca sessions they do a very strange version of it and it's not great, and it is transformed in just a couple of years. But I think George Martin's influence on this song, he must have told him, right, don't do it like that, whatever you do. And it suddenly becomes this powerhouse.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the kind of conservative record company man was probably the person most responsible for saying, crank it up a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Give it a bit more and give them the license to do it, you know.
Absolutely.
That, you know, I feel that he went alongside the machine and went... I'm trying to make the noise of somebody turning a handle. You know... Just give it a bit more.
Yeah.
Believe in yourselves. You know, and they were doing that, you know. And how long have they been in the recording studio by the time they made this record? Not that long.
Yeah.
And they're already getting near mastering it, you know.
I know. It's insane. Over the years, how's your journey with this album? Has it changed? Do you just think of it reminiscing about your childhood? Or do the songs mean something different?
I wouldn't say the songs particularly mean anything different. But, you know, if I were to reacquaint myself with what was so exciting about the Beatles, I'll go and listen to this and I'll go and listen to Hard Day's Night. Because, you know, that was them as a group before they kind of started going off down their own little ways, you know. And as I said, you know, that's the kind of side of the Beatles that I want to kind of rehabilitate. If possible, you know,
yeah.
Because I think we need to remember, you know, what they were about and the joy that they generated at their simplest.
We were talking recently about how the Beatles were kind of like a girl band. The fans were primarily girls up until Help, and then the boys became intro, and then it became chin stroking men listening to Pepper onwards. And it's easy. Is it easy to dismiss some of the earlier stuff?
Well, I think some people do make that mistake. Yes, I think, you know, I think people generally with pop music have a tendency to kind of take it with the seriousness with which it appears to be presented. So if the person making it appears thoughtful, you assume it's thoughtful. Not true, actually. Very often the absolute reverse.
Yes.
You know. And so some of the greatest things of popular music have just been, they've been light. And they should be valued for that, you know. There was certainly a case that, you know, once the screaming died down, you could hear the chin stroking. Prior to that, you couldn't hear a thing for the screaming, you know.
And of course, it's the sound of bristles.
If you go back and look at Hard Day's Night, what's intriguing is that the kids are kids. They're not even teenagers.
Yes.
They're kind of 11 or 12, you know? And that was kind of my generation, you know? But, you know, I think if you're too cool for the kind of classic period of Beatles, you're too cool.
A perfect ending. I think that sums it up. David Hepworth, thank you so much for your time. And if you do want to get hold of his new book, Nothing Is Real, go to davidhepworth.com. David, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.